All right. I think it's 4 o'clock, so I think we're going to get underway. Welcome to the Reboots of TV and Movie series panel. My name is Greg Wilson. I'll introduce myself in a second, but I want to hear from the other panelists first. One of our panelists, Lynn Thomas, her connecting flight was canceled, and so she's trying to get here, but it may not be on time or at all, so I hope you will forgive her. Maybe they can reboot the plane system where she is, but anyway.
Well, I actually have a replacement, Lynn Thomas. Yeah. Yeah. Someone 20 years younger.
Oh, yeah.
More attractive.
Right, exactly.
Or skimpier clothing.
That will bring in the younger yeah. set. Okay, great, good. That's good. Life imitating art. So we can get started with. I'm sorry, I didn't. Well, you had a swallow of water.
Yeah.
let me start with the left then.
Hi there. I'm Lawrence Person, science fiction writer from Austin, Texas. I also review films with Howard Waldrop for Locus Online, which I suppose is the reason du jour I'm on the panel.
Hey, I'm Anne Crispin. I write as A.C. Crispin, and I have written for a number of things that were recently rebooted, like Star Trek novels and V. I'm also the chair of Writer Beware, and I have a new book out. It is the prequel. It's not a reboot to Pirates of the Caribbean.
A preboot, perhaps.
I basically did for Jack Sparrow what I did for Han Solo in the Han Solo trilogy. I've told his backstory, starting when he's age 25, and told the story of how he first became a pirate captain. So, and in the beginning of the story, he starts off. He's working for the East India Trading Company as an honest merchant seaman. And his boss is Cutler Beckett, so you know things are going to change.
My name is Gregory Wilson. I am an associate professor of English at St. John's University in New York. I teach classes in creative writing and fantasy fiction, among others. One of my other hats is that I run a podcast called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans. I co-host that with fellow speculative fiction author Brad Bollier, which you can find more about at www.speculatesf.com, in which we address lots of subjects concerning the speculative fiction field, including, to a degree, reboots in literature, music, film, movies,
Walters?
And so forth. Yes, we do, including.
Let me get
you a card. Oh, great. See, networking on site. Yes, we do. Okay, so I'd like to start out by asking the panel about the pace of reboots first, and then I want to obviously give us a chance to talk about some specifics. But I want to talk a little bit about how the pace of reboots seems to have been accelerating, where you have not only the sort of basics that every 10 to 15 to 20 years gets a new treatment, but you seem to have now, within a very short span of time, retreatments of retreatments. It's a little weird sitting in a theater and looking at early trailers or pictures of Superman, which is about to be rebooted for the second time, by my count, within about a 3 or 4 year span, or Spider-Man, which is about to be rebooted again, or The Incredible Hulk, which is on its like 80th reboot, I think, at this point. And so what I wonder about, the first question is, what do the panelists think accounts for, assuming that I'm getting this right, this increase in reboots? Is this, we've run out of new ideas, and so we just got to keep going back to the well again? Or is there something else driving the sort of reboot phenomenon that we see?
I'm not sure. I think recently there has been an increase in the pace in some of the comic book-related properties.
Right.
I think classically, it's been 20 years more recently, but if you go back earlier into the history of film, there were reboots, so to speak, maybe every 10 years for some things before they got it right, for example. The version of The Wizard of Oz that we think of as the classic is actually the third version of the film. There were two versions. One was silent, and I forget what the second one was silent or not. I think it may have been, you know, Alice in Wonderland it was originally filmed in, I want to say, 1916 or something, maybe even earlier, of which not all of which survives. So it's not necessarily a new phenomenon. I think recently the accelerated pace, especially in comic book-related properties, is partially, well, there's several factors. One of the big ones is the fact that Marvel used to be sell or lease the rights to its characters to movies, and now it's its own company, mm-hmm. and its own company, and that its own film company specifically.
Yeah.
And so I think they want to, where contractually possible, I think they want to get those properties back under their roof, or conversely, the studio wants to hang on to those properties, and because they have to produce so many films in a certain amount of time to keep them, they are also producing the films to keep the rights to them. I think that's what's driving some of the comic book reboots and the Superman reboots, because no one really seemed to have liked the last Superman reboot.
Try again.
The Spider-Man is probably more in the Marvel direction. I think they want to keep the protagonist like 20 years old forever.
Okay. Anne, your thoughts about this?
My mind is blank. No. Oh, yes, speaking to the mic. They have big signs in the green room that says, speaking to the mic.
Thank you.
And I think a lot of it is, especially with the recession, I think studio executives, et cetera, are fearful for their jobs, and there's a component of that. They are going, well, you know, Spider-Man did very well before, so it will do well again with a new generation. You know, every 10 years you can turn it over and the kids are old enough to see it, etc. And so they're going, oh, let's go with a sure thing. That's some of the mindset there, whether they admit it or not. That's what I think, anyway. And in some cases, I think that there's also a sort of a hubris about it. It's like, this is Star Trek the way it should be done, and it should have been done, and I can do it better. And I disagree, at least for the recent reboot on Star Trek. I didn't like it at all. As for V, Kenneth Johnson worked for I don't know how many years, going around. He was a a well-known producer. He'd done a lot of things, and he never forgot V. V was his signature work. It was the second most popular miniseries of all time at its time, second only to Roots. So it he really wanted it to come back. He wrote some books. He took the first two-thirds of one of my books and wrote an epilogue on it, and it's got his name first. And I was like, okay, I didn't own it anyway. This is part of why you have to have a certain mindset to write media tie-in stuff in addition to original things, she added hastily. I think that there is a certain component of CYA and with the downturn, they're looking for sure things, and that's their way of trying to find them with reboots.
It may also be that the problem is that almost invariably the third film series sucks. I mean, pretty much the same case for Spider-Man, for X-Men, and they rebooted both of those. And hopefully, because Christopher Nolan is really, really good, this won't affect the third Batman film, but who knows. So I think that was one factor behind it, and the feeling that in Superman and Hulk, the previous incarnations did not get the character right, either from a canon viewpoint or a popular viewpoint either.
Well, let me ask a follow-up to that. Is the suggestion then, I think, and we were talking a little bit before the panel, so I have a feeling I know what you're going to say on this, but is the feeling then that reboots have been or are predominantly based on previous failure? I mean, are reboots coming in an attempt to overcome what got screwed up the last time in some cases? And should we be sort of supporting that as a positive trait? I mean, you suggested that this is kind of the result of hubris in some cases, and so maybe in that, I guess you would say that it's not such a positive trend. But if a reboot is trying to get something right that wasn't done right the first time, is that a trend that ought to be encouraged then?
Maybe. He said definitively.
Okay.
If it was something that I really, really liked the first time and they say it's even better the second time. For example, I love the original Karate Kid movies, and I was very exposed to them because I had a son who was taking karate, and he was like 8 years old or something when they first came out, mm-hmm. and I saw all those movies a couple of times. And I was like, when I heard they rebooted it with Jaden Smith, I was like, But I'd seen the kid when he was like five years old, and what was it, The Price of Happiness or whatever it was called, with his dad, and I thought, and it was on Netflix, so I clicked it on. I loved it. They said it in China. It was very well done. They gave, Jackie Chan did not make faces at the camera. He played it straight, and yeah. He was very good. The kid was good. It was really good. I loved the Chinese background and the photography and everything. Every so often, a reboot will actually be better than the original. I've had people tell me that the reboot of True Grit is better.
Yeah. Yes.
Some people think so. Anyway, so I'll look at it myself. And to me, the first True Grit was ruined by the fact that Glenn Campbell had obviously never been on a horse before. These times, I'm a horsewoman. These days, they actually take actors, and you can see them riding around, paddocks, learning to ride. I mean, they taught all those people to ride in Lord of the Rings, so they all knew how to ride, so nobody was bouncing. Poor Glenn Campbell, they stuck him on a horse, and he's clutching the saddle horn with both hands and going... And if that horse had not been on tranquilizers, it would have thrown him into the sagebrush. It was so distracting, I couldn't even hardly see the movie. Of course, John Wayne could ride, but Glenn Campbell was very distracting. And in this one, everybody can ride, because they taught them to. That's what they do nowadays. For one thing, it makes their insurance better if these people can actually control the horses instead of just sitting up there passively. So I think it's possible that a reboot could be better, and I think that's obviously what they're striving for. Nobody sets out to make a really terrible movie, at least not unless you're like Rocky Horror or something, which is supposed to be, terrible because it's camp.
Right.
I don't know. I think the people at the asylum set out to make bad movies.
Make bad movies?
Yeah. I don't think they have any illusions that they're trying to do anything worthwhile. So, Mega Shark versus Transcendent Gatoroid or whatever's coming next.
I never saw that.
Probably not going to be a Hugo nominee. I can safely assume. I like the reboot of True Grit, or the remake, really. I'm not sure it's fair to call a remake a reboot, because there's not going to be True Grit 2. Grit harder, right?
Grit truer.
Yeah. Son of True Grit.
Grittier.
Mainly because I thought it is closer to the Charles Portis novel. That it has the darker tone of the Portis original novel, which I enjoyed.
Which I did read, and I noticed the difference when I wasn't wincing at Glenn Campbell, yes.
Yeah. I think the most successful reboot, real reboot, of a property that was not really good to begin with is, of course, the modern Battlestar Galactica. Because, let's face it, the original sucked the farts out of dead cats, There was some good acting in it, and some of the business was interesting, but it was just a bit appallingly abysmal and stupid in many manifest ways. And the reason the reboot worked was actually due to financial constraints. They went, we can't really afford to do lots of Cylons, so we got to do something else. Like, how about if the Cylons looked like people? Yeah, we could maybe try that. And of course, that shaped the entire arc of the series.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, let me throw out two examples of reboots that I've heard mentioned that we either all agree didn't work, or one or two of us think didn't work. Because it strikes me that they didn't work in different ways. And so the point that I'm trying to get to is, what is the anatomy of a good reboot or a bad reboot? Superman is one thing that came up already, Superman Returns. And one of the things that's interesting about that is Superman Returns is a almost in some ways painfully reverential look back to the Christopher Reeve-style Supermans, right down to the look of the main actor, right down to the sort of the approach, the design, the music. It really feels like, Superman 2.5, or, the sort of intermediary version, let's say. And so one of the criticisms of that movie was too respectful. Way, way too kind of deferential, let's say, to Reeve in particular as Superman. On the other hand, you have the relatively new, from a couple years ago, Star Trek, which I think you would suggest was too dismissive of the original. J.J. Abrams, you were saying before, kind of chuckling about the fact that he never saw the original Star Trek before actually going to do a reboot of Star Trek. So here, we had a reboot that was utterly dismissive in some ways of the original series, assuming that we didn't like that particular reboot. So the question would be then, so two reverential, not good. Too dismissive, not good. What is the anatomy of a reboot that works? Like, how do we thread the needle and maintain interest and sort of connection to the source material without at the same time doing just the kind of boring sentimental pastiche, which is what Superman Returns ended up being?
Well, keep in mind that I haven't seen Superman Returns. But,
oh, really?
But I'm not a big Superman fan.
Okay.
I think he's a very difficult character because he's so overpowered.
Yeah.
That there's no real way to make him interesting. There's no real way he can lose. And what really pissed me off about the Christopher Reeve Superman is because Superman wasn't overpowered enough anymore, now he gets to go back in time anytime he screws up. Well, what's the fucking point of the entire film, okay? Or anytime he fights anyone, I lost, better go back in time and reset it. So it just sort of ruins the entire continuity of the suggested universe to me. So that's why I was not on board.
Okay.
And the impression I got, however, was not necessarily so much that it was too referential, but that it was too dull and Superman was too wimpy, was what I heard.
Mm-hmm. Still could bend a bullet with his eye, but
yeah.
But you know, but wimpy in other ways. You have a thought about that?
I actually, thought Brandon Routh looked pretty good. But that might be my hormones talking. And I agree, there wasn't an exciting enough plot and all that sort of thing. When a franchise starts to go sour, I never liked any of the remakes of Star Wars. The first trilogy, I thought that they were all. I thought they got better. The first one, I thought I would rip my hair out. If that little kid screamed yippee one more time, I was going to just do something savage. And then the second one, minorly better. And the third one, okay, it was all right. If they'd started off at that level, I would have been a lot happier. And
it's about as good as Return of the Jedi.
The weakest
really.
of the three. Original films, yes.
Yes.
I would say that. And it's a tough thing to do. When it's done well, I take my hat off to them. When it's done poorly, there really just is no way to clean up the mess. And I guess we were supposed to think with the Star Trek reboot that, they said, oh, this is an alternate universe, and we were supposed to understand that when, Kirk had no brother and all, his mother died and all this other stuff, it was, I didn't like it either. that we had now been put into an alternate universe, and so this was not to be the same universe. And but it wasn't just the fact that I thought Spock and Uhura were terribly, terribly out of character, because Mr. Spock would never have had an affair with one of his students, and an officer under his command. That's just not Spock, that's not Vulcan, period, end of story. But the science was crappy. I mean, they had to build a drilling platform to get that red matter that was denser than dark matter, into the core of the planet. All they had to do was drop a thimbleful, and it would have gone right in there and disrupted it, and it would have gone through everything.
But
this is silly. It's just silly.
We have to admit that the original Star Trek was not exactly a paragon of absolute scientific accuracy.
It was rubber science, but admittedly, Gene Roddenberry and Gene Kuhn were working with this tiny little budget, and they did for the first season pretty well, quite well, and the second season pretty doggone good, and the third season
not so.
I never, I didn't even see the third season. Until years after it first aired, because I went upstairs, I had a date first night it came on. It was one of, I was in college, my first year in college, and I said to this boy who had asked me out, okay, I can go, but I can't leave till 10 because Star Trek is coming on. And he said, oh, I've never seen it. And I said, well, it's really good, and I'm hooked, and I have to see it. So would you mind watching it with me in the dorm? And he's like, no, okay, and then we can go out. And he's like, he comes down, he sits there, and what comes on? Spock's brain. I did not forgive the franchise for 10 years, and I never saw the third season episodes, among which I wrote the sequel to All Our Yesterdays, and for many years thereafter, because of Spock's brain, and that wrecked my date. I was so depressed.
Well, one thing interesting, and this is one reason people do reboots, the Star Trek universe being an example, but also, you know that DC is rebooting everything, right? You heard that? That all their entire company, and the thing is that an extended universe like Star Trek or the DC universe, eventually you've got so much cruft and so many implausible things all living together that any sort of newcomer can't really approach the material, and it doesn't make any real sense when you sit down to think about it. And so there's that all-sweeping hand of God retcon is supposed to correct those flaws. And I think that's one reason behind the Star Trek reboot, and not so much the original series, but with the stuff that was added on with Next Generation and Voyager and Deep Space Nine and whatever, that you've got more and more of these serial implausibilities. And it's like, you know, why do you have latinum if Picard can go around handing anyone a matter replicator, right? So there's this sense that, well, let's start with a clean slate and go back to the original and what worked with the original. And I think that's the sense that some reason, from an artistic sense, people like reboots.
Well, that gives us a chance to talk a little bit then about a couple of specific examples, if we have them, of reboots that we have individually liked and not liked. And I guess we'll start with not liked, since we're already on that subject as it is. What are some of the let's see if we can each choose one that has particularly stood out to us as one that just really didn't work. And if it's one you've already said, feel free to say this is what it is. But what's one that just did not work? Already know? Is that softball in the air for you?
Insofar as personally annoying and irritating me, I would have to stick with the Star Trek film. I walked out of there and people were going, God, that was great. My husband and I looked at each other and said, did we see the same film? And fortunately for us, we didn't say anything very loudly, but I have said so publicly since then, and somebody says, who does she think she is, daring to dislike this movie? And I said, well, I have as much right to an opinion as anybody. And so anyway, I have to stick with that one as the one that personally annoyed and upset me the most, because I really had a stake in Star Trek, and I was very, very fond of it. And I spent, years of my life writing those books, so I cared a lot about it, and I wanted to see it treated respectfully, and I don't think it was. And that bothered me. I think if Gene Roddenberry had seen it, and he had his flaws as a director and a creator, the poor man would have been, under the ground long before he was. Actually, they shot him into space, so, but they brought him back. But his ashes were taken into space. It was pretty interesting. They weren't released there, but they were taken into space.
This is more of a remake than a reboot, but certainly there's been no more loathsome critical task that I've had to do since I've been reviewing movies for Locus Online than to see the remake of The Wicker Man. Yes. I feel your pity, and I endured the pain so some of you wouldn't have to. It was just a film that had abso-frickin-lutely nothing going for it. It was the original had its problems. The original came out in, I believe, 1974, which was probably about 6 years past its sell-by date, really, because it's very much a summer of love film. Post Summer of Love, a lot of the impact of that film sort of went away. But this was just badly written. Did not make a lick of sense. Nicolas Cage, with his usual unerring script sense, just picked another real turkey because that they were
Ghost Rider.
Well, let me tell you, Wicker Man makes Ghost Rider look okay by comparison. I mean, Ghost Rider's freaking Citizen Kane compared to the remake of Wicker Man. Ghost Rider is merely an overblown mediocrity. Wicker Man was just bad. Oh, speaking of just bad and really, really bad ideas, they are making a sequel to Manos, The Hands of Fate.
Oh, outstanding.
Yes, they even got Tom Nyman to come back and play the master, with the hands. And the question of whether it's a good idea to make a remake of one of the worst films ever made, well, I think this is beyond your mere mortal ideas of good and bad. Yeah. So that's it. The Search for Manos, The Search for Valley Lodge is supposedly coming out in 2013. We shall see.
It's something a guy did not expect that role to come back to. You want what? Again? I'm going to choose one that may seem a little bit unusual because it came to me related to a second reboot is what made me realize how bad the first one was. And I'm one of the few people alive who does not like the Batman movies with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. I was a kid who grew up with a sort of Frank Miller version of Batman, which was taking this tortured, deeply complex hero seriously, as presumably he takes, you know, we're supposed to take his adventures and his ideas seriously. It took him seriously in the same way. And very obviously, the campy TV show did the exact opposite of that. And so rather than trying to do a little bit of what Christopher Nolan did, instead, Tim Burton decides to do some... Well, he decides to make a Tim Burton film. So since Johnny Depp wasn't old enough yet, he went around and found... And Helena Bonham Carter was unavailable, I guess. He went and he decided that I'm going to get... I'm going to put together a bunch of... I'm going to angle my camera this way all the time. And then I'm going to put it too close at some times and too far at others. And then I'm going to have Jack Nicholson take over the entire Batman movie and make it Joker with Batman as a sort of sideshow. And have him mug for the camera repeatedly. And then, you know, we're all going to buy into it, and it's pretty eye candy, and it feels deep because the camera's like this, right? I mean, you know, if the camera's like this, there's got to be art going on there. What I objected to most was that it, you know, jettisoned the idea of Frank Miller entirely. It sort of thought that you were getting over the camp a little bit of the TV show, but not really so much. And every subsequent movie just had us descend further into camp, you know, until we got to the dreadful Batman and Robin, and then films that will not be named after that. And one of the things that brought that home to me, especially, was watching the exceptional reboots done by Christopher Nolan, in which they said, first of all, he did go back to Frank Miller. He did read those series of Batman comics, as opposed to J.J. Abrams laughing about not reading Star Trek. He did, although he had not done all that much with Batman before, do extensive research on this subject. And so what he took from it was the depth of Batman's almost, you know, theoretical psychosis, you know, this kid who saw his parents shot down in front of him, and makes that the sort of underpinning of what makes him into Batman, and yet, brilliantly, doesn't turn him into the psychotic that, let's say, the Joker is. He turns him into someone who's at the edge, but doesn't go over, because he did have his father, whose memory always stayed with him. And that distinguishes him from the Joker, from the criminals that he chases, and that was the needle that Miller successfully threaded in his books, which Nolan, I think, brilliantly understood. And so it was odd because he had to do not just a reboot, but he had to sort of make you forget two versions of Batman, right? Say, forget, none of that ever happened. Let's pretend that we actually took Batman the way the, you know, Frank Miller wanted us to take Batman and his approach towards it and looked at it in the process of his movie. So I guess that's going to stand for both my good reboot and bad reboot. First Batman, ugh, but the second set with Nolan, both the original and The Dark Knight, really, really well done, which allows me to segue into a good, from each of you, a good reboot that you think did this well.
Obviously, Galactica would be my yep. main, just because the original was... I mean, they really did make a silk purse out of a sow's ear with that. Until it sort of fell apart at the very, very end. But until then, it was the smartest, you know, most realistic and convincing science fiction show on TV pretty much ever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I guess I would say... For all its flaws, I liked the reboot of V pretty well. I didn't like it in the very beginning, but I got to like it much better in the second season, especially the second half of the second season, when things really began to move and plot lines they had laid down began to bear fruition. And they brought back Diana, and that really riveted me. And they had some interesting things from the original show, the idea of a priest who was very torn about the fact that the visitors had come, and yet he found himself working with the freedom fighters. But they didn't have the same characters, which actually probably was a good idea. They didn't have a reprisal of Mike Donovan or Juliet. Instead, they had people, you know, with issues, and they began changing their lives. And the visitors themselves, I mean, Anna was every bit as coldly calculating and bad as Diana ever was, and that's how you kill your mother. So I kind of like the look of the visitorship and all. Admittedly, it had its flaws, but I wish they had given it the chance to have a third season, because I think they were finding their footing, and I liked it. I mean, I kept watching it. Even I watched the first one and went, well, I don't know, I guess I'll keep going. And I watched a few more, and I was like, God, this is paced glacially. But I made it through the first season because I was interested. And then the second season, I was like on the verge of giving up.
When all of a sudden, doors closed back.
Yeah, thank you. I was going
to
ask.
All of a sudden, things really, you know, began to move along.
Thank you.
And I mean, I thought the last episode was quite riveting, and I was so happy when, what's his name? Tyler? Was his name?
Yeah.
When she killed him, I was like, yay! I hated that kid. So I was like, what is the best thing that ever happened to me? He's dead, yeah. So anyway, I really did think that they made a pretty good effort at that. It was too little too late, I guess, and it's canceled now, but that's what I'd have to pick.
Okay. There's also there are some reboots that just look so dreadful you don't even bother seeing them. I mean, like they tried to reboot Kolchak, the Night Stalker, and it's like, you know, that was Darren McGavin. You know,
yeah.
that was 90% of the charm right there, because yeah. he was so brilliant in that role, as he is in so many of it was in so many of his roles, that I just didn't see any point watching it without him. And I hear it was nothing to write home about.
And not quite in the reboot format, but a similar thing to that I've heard from some people is the new Jason Bourne movie, which people say Jason Bourne really is Matt Damon, at least on screen, and it's going to be hard for people to watch, you know, another person taking that on. Again, I recognize it's not a reboot in the traditional sense, but there is something to be said for the idea of the kind of consistency of the character in that sense. I'm sorry, say again? Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's already, I think it's in production or is, you know, well along the way. Yeah.
Speaking of reboots, yeah. Have you folks heard that The Lone Ranger has been scrapped for now, or at least is in some serious, there's a pretty good chance it won't ever.
What's your feeling about that?
But it's not like the previous movie versions of The Lone Ranger have been much to write home about recently. Remember this, what was it, 79 reboot or whatever?
I never saw
that. That was pretty dreadful, I hear. Clayton Spilsbury. A name not to conjure with. No, he didn't. No, he did not. Another really successful reboot that's sort of on the edge of science fiction is, of course, the James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
And with Daniel Craig, arguably Casino Royale, the best Bond ever.
Yep.
Certainly you can make the case for him or Sean Connery, I think.
But
depending on what you emphasize.
I would point out with him that, again, as I said with Batman, that is going back to Ian Fleming's initial assumption of what Bond was going to be, which is much more a thug with the possibility of being, you know, kind of cold and kind of elegant when he needs to be, rather than a kind of effeminate fop who, you know, kills guys because that's what the script tells him to do.
Like Roger Moore.
And I hate to say that, because there was a time when I was a kid when I thought Roger Moore was awesome. And, you know, but if you see, again, this is an example. You see someone like Daniel Craig take that role, and it's sort of, you get this moment like, oh, that's really what James Bond was supposed to be, as Ian Fleming intended him.
A little difference here between properties that are based on preceding literary properties and ones that aren't, because you've mentioned things like that several times, like now True Grit.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be different when you have that book to go back to, as opposed to just.
It sounds like it's almost time to open it up to questions.
Just
something in the same medium.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I think it probably. I don't know. It depends maybe on the quality of the source material. There are some cases where a movie drastically improves on you know, the original book from which it's taken, but that tends to be the exception rather than the rule. Yeah, it can happen on occasion, but not. Maybe, quite possibly.
People have said, you know, there are some people who are like, if they have friends who've never read comics, and they're like, they see the first Iron Man movie, and they're like, great, Or which graphic novels do I buy to get that kind of great Iron Man story? And you're like, well, none of them really. Yeah. Because there's bits from here and bits from there, but none of it ever put it together as well as that first movie.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But time changed that attraction, too.
Yeah, that's true, too. I think we have a lot of questions, so we have a couple minutes before, but there seems like a lot of people are interested, so we'll open it up for questions at this point. Yes, ma'am.
I'm fascinated with the sort of reboot or re-entry of Doctor Who. It's night and day compared to what it used to be in my eyes. Now, maybe because the world is a smaller place, and therefore they can use the BBC something that's completely good for around the world, that's a possibility. But I really have to give them a lot of props. They have tremendously changed their franchise, and they have. They've stayed true to what Doctor Who was about.
Well, they had more than $10 to do the special effects per episode. So that alone was going to get you a long way.
They also had a reboot built into the plot.
Right, I was just going to say, I mean, Doctor Who is sort of built on the theory of reboots in a way, so it's almost like it's kind of designed into it. I have to admit that I'm probably the one person at Worldcon who doesn't like Doctor Who, any of them. I'm sorry. I never got over just, I was like, a phone booth? What? I'm sorry. It's just too hokey. I just felt like I was watching Red Dwarf, you know, and Red Dwarf is meant to be Red Dwarf. Doctor Who is not meant to be Red Dwarf, but I just always read it that way. I don't know. It's just me. I'm crazy. I'm not the only one? Okay, thank God.
Do you mind if I just say goodbye?
Oh, yes. Thank you very much.
Sorry, I have an engagement, I was leaving when the Q&A started. Thank you very much. It's been a fun panel. I'm doing a reading. If anybody wanted my autograph and didn't get it today, I'm doing a reading on Sunday, so come and I will sign autographs. Okay? And there's a Writer Beware panel, so any of you aspiring writers, come to that, okay? You need to learn that stuff.
Yeah,
bye.
Totally agree. Thanks. Yeah, ditto on the Writer Beware. It's a great, great, great service. Okay, let's see. In the blue, please.
Do you hear anything about Dorothy of Oz?
No.
I believe it's on schedule and coming.
There's a ton of Oz projects coming.
Yeah, there are, and I'm actually thinking about Tin Man, which my...
Ooh.
Yeah, my wife liked it, and I didn't. But I think part of the problem is... You know, when sci-fi gets a hold of something, oh boy, or sci-fi gets a hold of something.
The syphilis channel.
The syphilis channel. It's always, you're running a risk. Yeah, I don't know a lot about that, I'm sorry. In the green, all the way back.
I would like to see a reboot, well done, of course, of Alien Nation.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It was called District 13.
Yeah.
No, District 9.
District 13 was a different film with lots of people climbing walls. It was also quite good.
District 9. Yeah.
District 9.
Sir?
What about the upcoming reboot of The Thing?
It's interesting because I much prefer John Carpenter's The Thing. The original version. Howard Walter, my movie review partner, does not, because he saw the original when he was a kid, and that's always been the original version for him. This, since it's a prequel to John Carpenter's The Thing, set in the Norwegian or whatever station that
the couple
first
days before,
comes across,
right? Yeah.
You sort of know how it comes out. And having seen a Scott Pilgrim versus the World, I'm not sure that Mary Elizabeth Winstead can actually act. So I don't know how it will be. I'm sort of waiting to hear on how it is. It could be decent, and it could not.
It would be interesting to see, and it's probably unlikely, but it'd be interesting to see if it takes into account Peter Watt's story and maybe draws a little bit upon the concept of that, at least imagining the alien's point of view in rendering that. Probably not. This may be a danger with doing what I called a pre-boot as opposed to a reboot, because you drain all the tension from it, right? This is one of the reasons the new Star Wars trilogy failed. You already know what's happening, guys. I mean, you know, there's only so much tension you can drive from something that you know the end result is. I mean, you know what's going to happen, ultimately. Sir?
Well,
I don't know. You have a thought about that first?
I'm not enthused about it, but I didn't like the Schwarzenegger version anyway. I don't think anyone's really done a good version of, as far as I know, any of Robert E. Howard's stories. I didn't see any signs that this one was going to be particularly good. Theoretically, Robert E. Howard's work should work great for the screen because he's very, very much plot and action driven in a through line.
Very visceral, yeah.
Very visceral. Yeah. So theoretically, his work should work fine, but so far it hasn't.
One wonders, again, I've been saying this throughout the panel, but what if he comes back to, you know, Howard's work again, rather than focusing on, you know, that's the key thing here, is we don't just need to reboot the last version. We sometimes need to reboot a couple of versions and go back to the beginning, you know, the fresh beginning. And what made that work was, it was literally pulpy, you know, Conan just swinging his sword with muscles ridiculously. I mean, you know, that's something which doesn't need nuance, okay? That's something which needs powerful action, and I think that, you know, maybe if they go back to Howard's original work and they don't get the Schwarzenegger mugging for the camera thing again, maybe that will help, but it's hard to say.
I haven't seen any signs that they're actually going back to Howard.
Yeah, probably not. Unfortunately. Probably not. Let's see. Gentleman in the back in the white shirt.
I'm curious.
God, I hope not. Can we close the gates, please? Like, really?
I've never been a Stargate devotee.
Yeah, I'm not either. But part of that is my frustration that to keep Stargate, they got rid of Farscape, which irritated the hell out of me. You know, if you have a choice between the two of them, I could have this really interesting. I know, Farscape wasn't as good at the end as it was at the beginning, but still, come on. Compare that to Stargate, please. Farscape was far more compelling, creative, interesting, unusual, and, by the way, was by far their most watched show, and yet because it was more expensive to produce, they thought, you know what, instead let's go do more Richard Dean Anderson work. I'm not a fan of the Stargate stuff in general. Yeah, sure.
I've heard a lot of stuff about how NBC owns some of these other cable channels.
Right.
And when something that's
Vindy Universal, yes.
Yeah. And if something's on one of the other stations that's starting to do it, it starts to compete with the network time, they kill it.
Yeah.
Is that true? I mean,
absolutely. I bet it's true in some cases.
You would think we're talking about network executives, so they're not like real human beings. You saw that Simpsons episode where they're like slime molds, right? You would think that if something got really, really popular, they would pull it and put it on their network, which is what essentially, what station did Dexter get broadcast on?
Wasn't it Showtime?
But it went to broadcast it.
Oh.
They rebroadcast it there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but what network is that on? What's the broadcast network? Because ideally, that's what you should do. It's like you've got this cable. If you've got a cable property that is doing really well and can be moved over, which, you know, the Sopranos can't, then you should theoretically pull it to your broadcast network. I don't know why more don't.
They did that with Battlestar, and they didn't get the right ratings based on what they're. But they didn't take the time to research what's the best channel.
Yeah, and they also didn't broadcast it, you know, start broadcasting originally on the network, I think, either.
Part of the problem, too, in all of these cases is that a lot of times, especially network executives, tend to panic. They're more prone to panic than most normal people, and will look at a list of ratings from a couple of months and be like, my God, we're losing in the 18 to 35 demographic by blah-ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba, quick, pull it, you know, sound the torpedo, you know, sound the alarms. And it's the result of that is that I think they miss a lot of what would, in the long term, be more profitable decisions. And that goes back to what I was saying about the Farscape thing. That was a largely financial decision based on a very simple how much it costs to produce per episode, not thinking about if it's bringing this many poor people in who are going to go to this channel to watch that, not to watch Stargate, but they might stay around to watch Stargate afterwards. In the long run, you're going to do much more for your channel. You're going to do much more in exposure and, you know, long-term profit. But it's all driven by very short-term snapshots. And the turnaround has become so accelerated. You can probably speak to this about even the review window. You know, you're supposed to review it, get it out there. If you get bad reviews, I review theater shows in New York City. If you review a show and the show gets bad reviews, in many cases, within a couple of weeks, the show will be dead. You know,
unless it's Spider-Man.
I was about to say that. But that show actually generated enormous amounts of publicity because everyone was like, oh my God, this must be some kind of a train wreck. And they wanted to go see what might be a train wreck. Turned out it wasn't. Actually, it was not nearly as bad as people thought it was going to be because they had about 800 times over to sort of, you know, try and get it right. But that was an example. example, and they had to accelerate the time frame of even the preview window because of all the interest in Spider-Man. So that's hurt the long-term sort of arc of these things.
So did you actually see the
No, my managing editor did.
Okay. All right, because
and liked it.
I think that as a director, Julie Taymor is an out-of-control set designer. Mm-hmm. So,
well,
I was very skeptical.
What made it work, according to my managing editor, is that they brought someone in who was very, very good on physical direction, acrobatic direction, and that's not Julie Taymor's strength. And so when they brought this guy in who had worked with Cirque du Soleil acrobats and things like that, all of a sudden the every week someone is in the hospital because of some accident stops happening because he understood the way physical bodies move, and it wasn't going to be a situation where people were running into each other over the audience. So I think that was one thing that helped in that case. Sir, in the black shirt.
You were talking a little earlier about what makes a reboot work and what
right.
doesn't. Mm-hmm. Kind of turn that around. You know, obviously, starting from your source material, if your source material wasn't that great to start with, like Battlestar Galactica, you have a lot more freedom.
Yep.
But if you're starting with something that's really beloved, do you think that possibly the reason some of these reboots for that type of material are horrible is because the really good people take a look at what they're thinking about doing and going, nah, I don't want my name associated with this. And it sort of ends up with the B team.
You're right. Well, there's a certain amount of chutzpah involved in rebooting anything. It's why the whole... Now, I, you know, Anna's gone now. I kind of like the new Star Trek. sorry. I kind of like the new Star Trek because I'm a huge original series nut. I recorded everyone on cable, took out the commercials, still have the original set, teach it in my classes. I love the, grew up watching it with my father. I love the original Star Trek. But I thought the new Star Trek brought a kind of energy and vitality back to the series that was sorely lacking. I'm sorry. You watch Nemesis and tell me that you're really fired up leaving about Star Trek. Dull as dishwater. So I actually think that stuff worked. And now I've totally forgotten the substance of your question. I'm sorry. About the sort of the beloved source material. I think that it's possible to do it if you keep in the back of your mind that what you're doing is not, you're not going to reinvent the wheel, but you're going to transfer what made the wheel great, the spirit of what was great about it, and try to infuse your new film, you know, property, book, whatever the case may be, with that. An example that I want to give is I happen to know the director of Hunt for Gollum very well, if any of you have seen that fan film, which was done on about a $5,000 U.S. budget. It is an exceptionally well-done film for that limited amount of money, and is in some ways reverential to Peter Jackson, and some ways takes it in its own direction. And the reason that I think it works as well as it does, it's not a perfect film, but it works very well, is because Chris Bouchard, the director, was both passionate about the source material, but understood what animated it. He understood that what animated it was connections between people that are fighting for the salvation of Middle-earth against what they see as an existential threat to its survival. And that was ultimately what drove much of The Lord of the Rings. He drove, and he took that aspect of it and put it into the new film. He was never going to get every part of it. If he slavishly took every part of The Lord of the Rings thing, it would have been a dreadful mashup. But he took what mattered, the essence of it, and put it into the film, and that's the art. If you can take the essence of something and put it into your reboot, that's when you have a success.
And actually, of course, Lord of the Rings is perhaps the best example of a successful reboot or remake. Since I don't think anyone would argue that the Bakshi version is better.
Oh, the Rankin Bass version, you mean, the later one,
And one reason that the Lord of the Rings, the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings, is he was so reverential to the source material.
Yeah,
and he wanted to make Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, not his Lord of the Rings. And he crammed as much into it as you could possibly ever hope that Hollywood would.
Yeah,
and faithful Hollywood would. You know, the few changes here and there compared to what it could have been, there were 100 things that could have been wrong with that film, and there were only like 4 or 5.
Yeah, and I was on a panel yesterday with Norman Cates, who worked on the Lord of the Rings film, and one of the things we were talking about was that Peter Jackson had to thread this very, very small needle again about somehow making that film work and be sort of truthful to the original books, making it work on screen, because what works in literature does not always work on screen, and if you had the entire Council of Elrond, and you had the entire, you know, unexpected party in every length detail, you would have had people, you know, fleeing the theaters.
I'm looking forward to 2 hours of John Galt's speech in the third
Atlas Shrugged movie.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I'm reminded of the Onion that did a thing about people's reaction to the new Star Trek, and they had this sort of these people dressed in Klingon outfits saying, you know, if I wanted to see, you know, good-looking people doing, you know, fun, exciting things, I would have gone to see some sports. Okay, where's the boring, you know, conference meetings? Where's all that? Where's my Star Trek, damn it? So that's a little unfair, but there's a little sign of truth, perhaps, in that one. We have time for one more very quickly. Yeah.
What do you think of the King Kong version with Peter Jackson versus Ray?
I thought it was a great two-hour film that went on 3 hours. I think the original is superior just because it is so tight and such a revelation compared to anything that came before. I would have liked the new version to have been pared down. I thought it was good. It was better than I thought it would be. But
King Kong. Yeah. And I thought I agree with that. I thought the end was a little self-indulgent because it was so long. I thought it could have been. It needed some more editing, in my view.
And the editor's cut of that film would have been
better. That's right.
How long was the original?
Like 89 minutes or maybe a little less.
Very tight.
Very tight.
That's it for us. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you.